Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're doing something a little different, a bit more ambitious than just looking at a new piece of research.
You really are.
We're going to be examining the very foundations of how we think, specifically the whole philosophical legacy that, you know, governs how we understand logic, creativity, all of it.
And we're doing this because our sources today, they're this fascinating mix of historical critique and a really deep look into an alternative system called Kata Kamuna.
Right.
And they argue that the greatest minds in Western history, I mean, we're talking Plato, Descartes, all the way to Freud, they accidentally built a kind of logical cage.
A cage.
A constraint that limits not just human originality, but also, and this is critical today, the potential of artificial intelligence.
And that's really the core conflict we want to jump into for you.
Yeah.
How is it that we're in this age where logic and data processing seem boundless, but these sources are telling us we're actually trapped.
Trapped by systems designed centuries ago.
Exactly. So our mission here is to explore this alternative, Kata Kamuna, which is presented not as some spiritual belief, but as a path to what it calls intellectual rehabilitation.
A shortcut, essentially. Yeah. A shortcut to universal truth that philosophy just completely missed.
Okay, so to set the stage for this, we have to go way back. We have to look at the first attempts to even reach a so-called universal truth.
Yes, and the source draws this brilliant comparison between two paths, both aiming for the exact same peak.
And that peak is what? Plato's theory of forms, the ultimate idea?
Precisely. Plato's way is described as the analog line. So think of it as this really rigorous, slow, time-consuming process. It's reason, analysis, trial and error.
The long, hard climb up the mountain.
The long, hard climb. It gave philosophers immense authority, of course, but it was slow. It lacked speed, and it definitely lacked immediacy.
Okay, so that's the analog path, the traditional philosophical route. What's the alternative that Kata Kamuna is supposed to be?
Kata Kamuna is presented as the super high-speed line. It's a system that gets to the answer directly, using what it calls pure intuition.
Pure intuition, but is it just a feeling?
No, and that's the key. It's based on a logical framework that bypasses all of that human-centered thinking. The proponents even say it's hard to believe because it gets to this universal truth without all the steps we're so used to.
Which raises a huge question, then. If this superhighway existed, why did modern philosophy miss it?
Well, the sources trace the beginning of this whole tragedy, really, back to Descartes.
Ah, Descartes.
Yeah. They argue he didn't just doubt the peak that Plato found. He completely failed to see that a faster path was even possible. Instead, he built what the source calls an extremely simple and short-sighted worldview.
And that would be his dualism, right? The famous mind-body dualism.
The very one. A separation that basically defined the next 300 years of thought.
Where the mind and matter are just fundamentally separate things.
Totally separate. He divided reality into two independent substances.
Huh.
You have the non-spatial thinking mind on one side.
And on the other.
The body. Just a purely mechanical thing, you know, following the law of causality. The thinking you was completely isolated from how the universe actually works.
But wasn't that sort of necessary? I mean, for science to take off, you had to treat the world like a machine you could analyze.
Oh, for the methodology, it was a huge step.
Mm.
But the consequence was that it trapped the entire modern intellect in that same analog methodology.
So what does that mean for you, for the learner?
It means if your mind is totally separate from the reality you're studying, then building any kind of theory becomes this monumental effort.
Like the sources say, stacking heavy stones one by one.
Exactly that. You're forced to construct these universal principles just from your own limited individual thoughts, completely divorced from the, you know, the dynamic structures of the universe itself. And this led modern philosophy straight into a dead end.
The dead end of human-centered thinking.
Because it just ignored all the nonlinear truths that exist outside of our own heads.
So Descartes builds the first wall. And then we get to Kant, who comes along and basically, what, reinforces the cage.
He solidifies it.
Yeah.
He essentially creates the operating system, the OS, that our common sense and now AI runs on. Kant's real achievement was defining the self-regulation of the intellect. He set the rules of the game.
Let's talk about what the source calls the a priori trap, then. This feels really crucial to why we're supposedly caged.
It is. Kant argued that our knowledge doesn't just come from experience. It's actually predefined by these innate fundamental structures.
Time, space, causality.
Right. They're the mental filters we use to perceive and organize everything. They're the framework that makes knowledge itself possible for a human.
So we can only see the world through these kind of built-in human goggles.
That's the logical wall he put up. And from that, he concluded that true reality, what you call the noumenal world, or the thing in itself, is just permanently inaccessible.
We can't ever know it directly.
Never. We can only know the phenomena, the world as it's filtered by our minds. And for a long time, this seemed like a totally unavoidable limitation.
Okay, that sounds pretty reasonable. Until you read the critique in our sources, which argues Kant's a priori is not universal truth at all.
And this is the real dynamite of this whole deep dive. The critique says that the a priori, our basic OS of time, space, and causality, is just a measuring stick.
A measuring stick.
Yeah, one that's rooted in the extremely limited physical and temporal scale that humans got through evolution. It's just the wisdom you need to survive as a human.
Wow. So if our fundamental operating system is really just a survival tool, then the limits we feel, that inability to see ultimate truth, that's literally the curse of human finitude.
It is. Our logic is bound by the fact that we need to live for, you know, 80-odd years on one small planet. It completely reframes the problem.
And this curse is directly inherited by AI.
Directly. Because AI is trained on human data and human logic, it's fundamentally trapped inside the same framework, inside Kant's a priori.
That's a staggering thought. So AI isn't breaking out of our logical cage. It's just operating with incredible speed inside the cage we built for our own survival.
It can optimize solutions based on our historical data, yes.
Yeah.
But it can't access knowledge that lies outside that very specific human scale.
And the source warns this leads to something called the inorganic homogenization of logic.
Yes.
Let's break that down. What does that actually look like in the real world?
Well, it means that if all your creativity, all discovery, is filtered through that same narrow finite lens, the human a priori, then all the answers are going to start looking more and more like.
So AI will always find the most optimal human answer.
But optimization isn't originality.
There's a great analogy in the source about a sunset.
Right. AI can look at a million pictures and poems about sunsets and derive the perfect, optimal way to describe one, the right color gradients, the ideal words, but the actual shaking of the heart you feel when you see one for yourself. That's an immediate, non-linear experience. AI's logic is sterile because it's derived from our limited, historical, human-centric data.
Okay, so we've got this lineage. Descartes separates mind and matter, Kant tracks us inside the a priori. Then, the sources say, psychology tried to find the key to the cage by looking at the unconscious.
And well, they ran into their own set of problems. They were searching for what the source calls consei. It's like a mix of sensibility, intuition, deep emotional experience.
And Freud basically turned this source of inspiration into a pitfall.
He did. He defined the unconscious primarily as this warehouse of pathological emotions. A place for repressed desire, trauma, all reducible to your personal past.
So by doing that, he basically pathologized originality itself.
He did. If true intuition comes from the unconscious, and the unconscious is just a source of personal sickness, then what does that make creativity?
Pathological delusion.
Exactly. And that framing just took the search for pure originality completely off the table for serious thinkers. If you wanted to be truly original, you were basically considered neurotic. A huge setback.
Now, Jung tried to go beyond that with his idea of a collective unconscious, right? Something universal.
He did. But the sources point out his limits, too. Jung just didn't have the logical tools to clearly separate emotional desire, Freud's pathology, from the pure intuition this is all about.
So he could sense it was there, but he couldn't map it.
Right. He was forced to use poetic language, metaphors, archetypes, and his concept of antinomy. You know, the tension between opposites, while it's insightful for inner conflict, it just cemented the idea that we are separate from our environment. We're these closed-off beings fighting internal battles.
So the philosophers built the cage, the psychologists explored the inside of it, but everyone missed a key to get out. What was that ultimate oversight?
The critical failure, according to the source, was this self-absorbed focus on the individual's inner world, which is, by definition, a closed system.
And by focusing inward, they missed something external.
They missed nonlinear similarity.
Okay, nonlinear similarity. That sounds technical. Well, what exactly is that?
Well, standard logic connects A to B through a clear chain of cause and effect, right?
Right.
Nonlinear similarity is the ability to logically connect subtle, seemingly unrelated patterns between wildly different things in the environment. Think connecting, I don't know, the behavior of subatomic particles to the structure of a cloud.
That's the kind of leap we normally call genius, or a flash of insight.
And because these thinkers lacked the transparent lens to logically link these things, they just defaulted to dualism, mind and body, human and environment. They dismissed nature's dynamic patterns, the macrocosm outside of us, as just unstructured chaos.
Which brings us finally to Kata Kamuna. This is presented as the fix for all of it, then. The separation, the a priori trap, the confusion.
It's presented as the logical remedy, yes. Not as ancient lore, but as an integrated information system. It deals with principles that are pre-linguistic and universal, sound, form, and concept.
So it's operating on a level below human language and survival logic.
A level that regulates the entire universe, not just us. The framework is laid out systematically. 21 geometric elements, 48 sound elements, and 80 yutai, which are like systematic chants.
And the scope of this is vast.
It's meant to describe reality from the beginning of the universe down to elementary particles. And crucially, it does this without putting the human observer at the center of everything. It gets rid of that human finitude that trapped Kant.
Okay, so how does that begin the intellectual rehabilitation?
Well, the framework sees the human body not just as flesh, but as an assemblage of elementary particles. And if those particles are in constant communication with this Senshikai,
the latent or potential world behind what we see.
Exactly. Then the source of ultimate truth isn't locked away at all.
So the pneuma world, the thing in itself that Kant said was inaccessible, suddenly becomes a source of real-time, non-linear information for us.
That is the logical jump. Kata Kamuna accesses the thing in itself because it deals with the universal principles of sound and form that regulate even Kant's framework. It basically goes around the logical wall by using the principles that built the wall in the first place.
So after this huge deep dive through philosophy's failures and this pretty mind-bending alternative, what's the takeaway for us? What does intellectual rehabilitation actually mean for you, the listener?
It means recovering true originality. It means learning to leap over that philosophical fence that we've all been raised inside of. The framework is meant to be a tool for getting answers from outside our own logical box, especially when our normal analog thinking hits a wall.
So it's not about thinking harder inside the cage.
It's about using a different kind of systematic logic to see the world as this unified informational whole.
And the proponent, Jinko Kei, doesn't just leave it at theory. There's a really provocative thought here for what comes next.
There is. The grand hypothesis defines thought or spirit, not as some mystical fog, but as an actual informational effect that's involved in the emergence of matter itself.
So consciousness isn't just some biological accident. It's fundamental to reality.
That's the claim.
Mm.
And it's a direct challenge to modern physics.
Yeah.
The source explicitly says the next step is to try and substitute Kata Kamuna concepts into the most rigorous calculation formulas of modern physics.
To do what?
The aim is enormous. To provide hints for solving things like dark matter or quantum gravity, and maybe even to prove, theoretically, how the mind actually interacts with and creates physical reality.
Wow. Substituting ancient concepts into modern physics to break the limits of human thought. That's where theory meets application in a really profound way.
Which leaves us with one final concept from the sources.
Jikujutsu.
What's that? It's this idea about the importance of the process, where knowing all the knowledge you just heard in this deep dive transforms into essential action, applied knowledge.
So if our thought process really is trapped by our own finitude, how can we use a new system like this to change not just what we know, but how we act? It's something for you to consider as you look at the intellectual fences in your own life and maybe decide how you're going to leap over them.